Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, South Africa's gambling surge tops 1.5 trillion rand, raising tough questions for regulators. Food security edges up, but millions of South Africans still go hungry. The recent Curo education deal reignites the debate over South Africa's broken system. And refurbished tech rebrands as aspirational and not second best. It's Friday, the 17th of October. Now, South Africa's gambling boom has exploded, with total bets topping 1.5 trillion rand last year. That is an astonishing amount of money, and most of it online. But I think the surge has also brought some serious questions about regulation, about tax leakage, about addiction, and whether the law is still keeping up. So let's discuss that in a little more detail. My guest is Lungile Dukwana, who's the Acting Chief Executive Officer of the National Gambling Board. Lungile, a very warm welcome to you. I'm interested to know how online gambling has grown so quickly and what makes it difficult to keep up with illegal operators.
Well, when we're presenting the annual report to the portfolio committee, one of the slides we actually projected on, we're talking to the growth of the online gambling. Now, if you look at it historically, initially we had casinos being the best performer and generating a lot of revenue over a certain period of time until we got to the period of COVID. The online betting was coming up quite nicely, and then it caught up very quickly during COVID because people were not allowed to go out and go to the casinos and all of that place. And then the picture changed completely. And now we had the online betting being the one that is going up the most and the casinos going down. So that is what we have really experienced over time. And now one of the contributing factors there being the fact that people now are no longer going to the casinos as they used to because that is available on their platforms, on their cell phones, on their desktop and everywhere, which then created ease of access in terms of delivering that.
Do we have one clear official figure on the true size of the online gambling market in this country?
Yes, we do have. For example, we presented the GGR in terms of how we actually doing as a country. And that GGR is actually a true indication of that in the context of what we know that is legal in South Africa. The illegal aspect is what we may not know, because by its nature, the legal remains illegal. You may not know all of the things that are actually happening on the illegal space. What we know about it is that we are seeing a lot of the proliferation from the outside companies that are not even licensed in South Africa operating online in South Africa. And that is the challenge we're dealing with as a gambling board, of making sure that we deal with the closure of those ones through your authorities like the Department of Communications, the CASA, and the other who are responsible for the ISPs, so that we can close that space and make sure that there's no ease of access of that nature online.
Are you able to give me a sense of how many illegal sites then are actually being shut down each month and how difficult it is to do that?
It is actually a very difficult task because you need to have those partnerships and you need to be alert because they know that when you actually shut down one, they go and change their IP address and come as something else. That is always possible to do. But on the figure that we had done in Parliament, I think previously we had given the size of about 90 illegal ones that we had identified. Up to this far, the last time I checked, we had closed up to about 23. And we are still going on closing them because it's also a function of collaboration with the other entities of the state, and we are prioritizing the issue of the MOUs with those ones so that there can be proper collaboration and dealing with this particular challenge of the illegal online gambling.
Of course, it does raise the question, doesn't it, about whether our current gambling laws then are still suitable for this digital world that we're operating in today?
Yes, it's a genuine question because, look, we have raised a few issues around the law itself, particularly as it relates, for example, to Section 11 and the issue of the online gambling per se. So there is a need to review that. And we know for a fact, because we're engaging the department from time to time, we talk to the minister from time to time, and we're at the portfolio committee, there is a great concern around the issue of the online. And there's work that is being done by the DTIC with some of the stakeholders to ensure that we are able to deal with the issue of the online. But suffice to say that the advertising that is happening is also not helping the cause. And that is what, as the NGP and the other provincial licensing authorities, we are focusing on to make sure that we clamp down on the issue of the online advertising so that it's not in your face. It is something that it must not be on their face, especially the wrong and the vulnerable population of our country.
Well, let's pick up on the advertising then. Advertising for gambling, as we know, is everywhere at the moment. What immediate steps need to be taken then to manage this better?
In fact, Jeremy, we are presenting that approach to the NGPC, which is a National Gambling Policy Committee that will be sitting, I think, towards the end of the month in terms of those proposals. But one of the issues is to stop using, for example, the issue of the influencers whose target is normally younger people in terms of the advertising. I think that's number one. Other issues are the times of operating or of advertising where the minors should not be exposed to the messaging and of gambling, so to speak, but also that there must not be misleading messages in the advertisements that actually put in place, but also the obeying of the licensing conditions. We do a lot of oversight visits to the provinces or provincial licensing authorities, and we raise some of these particular things and say that we need to obey the licensing conditions that have been given. So you can't be licensed in Mpumalanga or in KZN and then you advertise all over the country. Some of those issues are the issues that we need to look at closely with a view to make sure that there is harmony and cooperation in the implemented of those. We're also waiting with the advertising standards is the regulator to make sure that we deal with those ones from that perspective as well, so that we can take down some of them where we believe that they are not meeting those requirements, but also for the public to be able to report them accordingly.
Part of the problem, of course, is the gambling board itself and probably not capacitated enough to do the job that you want to.
Well, we can do with more resources. We can do with the capacity, more capacity coming in. But we need to be innovative, I think, as we look at it. For example, one of the approaches that we've agreed on is that we have stakeholders that we share the same interest with. So we need to make sure that we work with them. For example, we do work a lot now with the South African Responsible Gambling Foundation, whom are actually the ones who are doing a lot of education and are coming with programs to manage challenges related to gambling. The other ones we had identified is that the education programs that we engage with must be in collaboration with the provincial licensing authorities, but also they must be in collaboration with the universities. We must also work with SASA. There's work that is being done around those areas. And my team is in Eastern Cape now working with the universities and the TVET colleges in the Eastern Cape, particularly the Qabega area, because we identified that that is one of the challenges that we have. But I think that there will be a need for us also to partner with the law enforcement agencies with a view to have the crime of illegal gambling, particularly with the internet cafes and the related stuff, being declared as a priority. Because if we can strengthen that becoming a priority, then we're going to turn the corner in relation to that issue. But of course, we are supplementing some of the issues that have to do with the internal capacity that we are dealing with. And I'm dealing with that. We are moving on some of the issues.
But just finally, also part of the problem is the gaps that exist in legislation. Maybe provincial gaming boards have too much power regarding licensing. You listen to any ad on the radio, for instance, most of them say licensed by the Mpumalanga or the Western Cape gambling boards, even if it's not in Gauteng or any other province.
Look, it's the nature of the legislation that was adopted. Because if you look, for example, at the National Gambling Act, it actually says that we are exercising oversight with the provinces, with the provincial licensing authority. It is like that. Now, if we have to review that particular legislation, perhaps there can be a more innovative way of making sure that we strengthen that particular area, but we have invested more on ensuring that there's cooperation and collegiality between the PLAs and ourselves as the NGB. But there's always a risk that somehow there may be differences of interpretation of the law. And I don't think that it's desirable to see ourselves and the PLAs taking each other to court on some of those things. That is why we have the NGPC, where we then smooth out some areas where we not be seeing it with the same eye or interpreting it in the same way, so that we can be able to have those ones. But I think that once the laws are revised, as I know that there's some work that is being done there, we're likely to see a better coordination and cooperation between those structures.
Thank you very much indeed. Lungile Dukwana is the Acting Chief Executive Officer of the National Gambling Board.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, food security remains one of the country's defining challenges, but there's a small step in the right direction, I'm happy to report. According to the new South African Food Security Index, it's commissioned by the ShopRite Group and independently produced by economists at Stellenbosch University. Food security levels improving slightly this year, rising from a low of 44.9 in 2023 to 56.4 in 2024. Just by way of background, the index measures accessibility, affordability, dietary diversity, and stability. But while the gains are encouraging, hunger obviously remains a national crisis. Nearly 20% of households, let me repeat that, 20% of households still not eating enough diverse food groups. Let me give you a broad overview. I'm in conversation now with Professor Dieter von Fintel, who is a development economist at Stellenbosch University. Dieter, a very warm welcome to you. Let's start with the top line. How significant is the improvement in the index and what's behind it?
Yes, thank you, Jeremy. So the previous year's index was really a low point. It was the lowest we've measured since 2010 from when we have data. And it was below average. And edging above to 55 really suggests to us that we've moved into above average territory. So is movement in the right direction, even though it's not perfect yet, right? We still do have a serious problem with food security in South Africa, but at least there's a move in the right direction. Now, the driving forces behind this year, hunger remained relatively stable. If we look at whether people are satisfied with the kinds of foods they're eating, that's improved a little bit. But the real big ticket item here was that food price inflation has gone down, which means that there's greater stability for households to be able to make choices and to be able to make better food choices. It's about a little bit about affordability.
But it's still balanced on a knife edge, though. All well and good to see that we have a slightly more contained food inflation. But you've got to ask the question how sustainable it is going forward, given so much national and global volatility.
That's a very good point, because we saw this after the COVID pandemic and at the start of the Ukraine war, where food prices skyrocketed and where they went up much quicker than the general inflation rate. And there's no guarantees that that stability can maintain. However, if you look at some predictions, for instance, from the Bureau for Food and Agricultural Policy, they've predicted that food inflation should remain stable at about 4.5% throughout 2025. But at any moment, international shocks could upend the situation and could destabilize the situation. So you're quite right in saying that we shouldn't be satisfied with this over the long run.
Dieter, this measurement of dietary diversity is interesting. It's a key measure. 20% of households eat too few food groups. What does that tell us about deeper structural dietary issues?
This is a very important matter, because generally if individuals can consume more food types, they're getting the right micronutrients for their bodies to function and for them to be able to participate in economic and daily life. We need various foods to be able to function optimally. So these are benchmarks which one can use. If we're consuming too few food groups, we're concentrated maybe in unhealthy foods, which are usually the cheapest options. And as soon as we're able to afford more options, then there's a greater diversity. So it reflects a bit in affordability, and are we able to afford the healthier, more expensive foods? Now, what diet diversity is strongly correlated with aspects such as children being stunted, whether they are too short for their age, which is also a predictor for really their chances in life, for their long-run prospects in the labor market, for instance. So these links are very long, but they do influence each other. We think that nutrition is really foundational to just do well at school, which obviously then opens up doors into the economy.
Interesting to note that the Free State shows the weakest diversity, almost half of the population consuming three or fewer food groups. Do you have any notion as to what is driving provincial disparity?
Yes, so obviously access to markets is a big thing, and also local agricultural conditions. So if markets aren't integrated, then individuals won't necessarily be able to access all the types that might be available. Or if there's local climate shocks or local weather shocks that shock in a particular year, then suddenly a food group might become unavailable. Also, if it's more expensive to, for instance, transport a particular kind of good, let's think about meat, which is usually one of the first foods to fall off when households are under pressure, then some areas where it's more difficult to transport meats and things like fresh fruits and vegetables, which are important to diet diversity, if households cannot access these because of location, that's what sometimes drives some of these disparities, these geographic disparities.
And I suppose the answer is obvious, but female-headed households are more likely to be food insecure. Why and how do we change that?
Yes, this links very closely again to the labor market because we know that female-headed households also face a labor market penalty. They struggle to find the same kinds of jobs that men do. And often there's also, in female-headed households, they're heading that household on their own so that there's fewer salaries and fewer income sources in those households. So they generally, in all countries in the world, but including South Africa, it is synonymous with more vulnerable households and a larger care burden on these women who head these households. So we see this risk also playing out in terms of dietary diversity and also in their ability to keep their children away from hunger.
And just a final one, are there specific policy levers that would make the biggest difference in pushing the index meaningfully higher in the short term?
So you mentioned the short term, but I would like to start with the structural issues because we've spoken about employment quite a lot. I think that's the baseline effect that will change the index meaningfully and that will bring it up quite consistently. I think that's what's really going to affect hunger and also improve diet diversity over the very long run. Over the short run, there are other aspects. We can ensure price stability. This involves anything from stable monetary policy to being able to procure foods from affordable sources. And this also links then to trade policy and being able to import the right foods at the right prices. There are other aspects which one can look at. Of course, we have a school feeding program in South Africa, which has a very wide reach. We saw in the COVID period when that wasn't happening, how influential that was at keeping hunger at bay, and that it's really important to support the food security of our children at this stage.
Thank you very much indeed. I've been in conversation with Professor Dieter von Fintel, development economist at Stellenbosch University.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, it's fair to say I don't think there can be any argument that South Africa's education system is continually cracking under pressure. We see crumbling buildings, packed classrooms, and poor learning outcomes. Now, the recent Curro Holdings deal has reignited a debate around private innovation and whether it can help rescue a failing system. Innovator and thought leader Dr. Sam Duby, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Future of Energy, believes the answer isn't in tinkering. He says it's bold systemic reform built on partnerships between business, civil society and the state. So let's test that argument a little further. Sam, a very warm welcome to you. Let's start with a headline. Why do you believe that the country's education crisis can't be fixed through incremental improvements? What makes it a structural problem?
So I think there are numerous different aspects to this problem. I think that the evidence is on the wall. Things are not working as they currently are. And that's why I think this move by Yanni Mouton is such an interesting one, because not only does it potentially offer a interesting roadmap towards better and higher quality education nationally, but it also points very clearly to the fact that things are just not working the way they are.
In fact, you go on to say it's a signal moment, which is an interesting choice of word. It also reveals a lot, doesn't it, about the state's current capacity versus private sector appetite, which has long been there.
That's absolutely right. Yes, I think the ideal scenario in my mind is that the state will be able to provide decent education for all of its citizens. The fact is, our state as it currently exists is not able to do that, and therefore the private sector is stepping in to fill that gap. I don't necessarily think a private sector solution is the ideal scenario more long term, but the plain and simple fact is that private enterprise is able to offer better services for the people on the ground than the state is able to do. And that's sadly a failing of the current situation here in this country. But we should applaud people like Yanni Mouton for stepping in to fill that space, because it shows that it can be done. It shows that high quality education can be delivered to South Africans affordably. And I think that paints a really real and stark contrast to the situation that we've been in so far.
But you make a very good point about over-reliance on the private sector, because critics will say if you rely too much on private capital, it risks deepening inequality.
I completely agree. But the situation with education in South Africa at the moment is absolutely diabolical. 80% of 10-year-olds cannot read for meaning. The baseline that we're starting from is so low that any step that we can take, whether it's private or public, to improve the educational outcomes, surely that is a blessing, even if the long-term reliance on private capital is something we should try and avoid.
So where do you think specifically, Sam, government is failing? Is it funding? Is it policy execution? Is it accountability? Is it more than that, or a combination of all of it?
So I think it's a combination of all of it. South Africa has such incredible systems in many ways, but that's arguably on paper. The problem is, as many of the recent scandals will testify, the recent scandal with the hospital in Johannesburg, for example, where billions of rands were siphoned off. The fact is, it's not getting to the ground. The money that is petitioned and is set for particular tasks is simply not being operationalized in that way. And I think that that's a question of accountability. There are so many different angles to that. But I think that if the money could be spent as it's meant to be spent, I think we'd be in a very, very different situation.
Aside from funding, teacher quality is also at the heart of the crisis, and perhaps that's more difficult to solve. Is there a structural intervention that you think might shift the dial faster on this particular problem?
Yes, I think so. I think teacher quality is directly linked to how much teachers are going to be paid. So if you look at countries like Finland, where teachers are paid exceptionally well, obviously it attracts high quality people to the role. Therefore, the quality of teaching goes up. So I think the structural gap there is that teacher salaries are just too low. These are constantly being eroded. And also the fact that our particular angle, which is on the energy, the fact that a school's energy costs are going up and up and up and up means that they can't afford to pay new teachers. And one of the things that we look at with our smart schools model is that by installing solar on schools, the schools themselves can save enough money to employ extra teachers. Because I do think paying extra teachers is the critical linchpin to providing better quality education outcomes.
You've got to find the teachers first, though, haven't you?
Got to find the teachers, but I can tell you, if you're paying good money, those teachers will come.
You speak very highly of the Curo deal, and I'd suggest to you, Sam, that partnerships are easy to talk about and maybe easy to sign, but maybe a little more difficult to execute. And I wonder if there is a governance model or a mechanism that might make business-state collaboration work efficiently and in the long term at scale.
Yes, I mean, I think there absolutely is. I think there are countless examples. Again, my sector, which is specifically energy, is, and particularly on energy access in rural areas, and we spend a lot of time working across Africa, is a classic case where there needs to be some partnership between public and private sector, whether that is just the public sector providing the right kind of regulations for the private sector to offer and operate efficiently, or whether it's the public sector actually directly employing or using public or commercial mechanisms to deliver services. I think there is huge amounts of scope for public and private sector partnerships. It just has to be done in the right way. And unfortunately, the public sector is not considered to be a reliable partner. So you can see why people like Curio are stepping in to fill the space, because they believe, and I think quite rightly so in this case, that purely private sector delivery models are the only way really to get these high quality education outcomes out. And that's a sad indictment of the state of the public sector.
It's a sad indictment, but the model will work if there is an equitable spread. And the risk, I guess, is that we can have innovation and technology adoption, but it can't just benefit a handful of schools. It's got to transform outcomes system-wide. Again, easier said than done, I imagine.
That's absolutely right. And again, referring to our smart schools model, this is essentially a private sector led solution, but it would be a very simple mechanism for the public sector to pick up on. As I say, installing solar on schools and essentially providing a much cheaper form of long-term energy means the schools can save huge amounts of money and therefore employ more teachers. So that would be a very simple mechanism for the public sector to pick up on. The fact that it's been driven or innovated by the private sector is neither here or there. So I think that it behooves the public sector to learn from the innovators that are coming from the commercial space and apply those sensibly, if not to work directly with them.
Dr. Sam Dube, thank you very much indeed, Chief Executive Officer of the Future of Energy.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now let's move on to this, and we love a story on the show about saving money, and as rising costs force South Africans to stretch every rand, more and more consumers are looking at refurbished and pre-owned goods, not as a last resort, but as a smart, aspirational choice. So I want to introduce you now to The Hawker. It's one of the new players in this landscape, trying to reshape the second-hand electronics market with grading, guarantees and trust at its core. But I'm wondering if this model can really change consumer behavior in a market that I think it's fair to say has long been plagued by skepticism and scams. So Managing Director at The Hawker, Mishan Ratan, good evening to you and a very warm welcome. You're positioning this as more than a second-hand store. I'm interested to know what makes your model fundamentally different from more informal and unregulated resale operations in South Africa. And we know what an appalling reputation many of those have.
Sure. And thanks for having me on the show, Jeremy. So what makes us different, I think, is, you know, there's a couple of things. And what we set out to achieve was not just, you know, sort of the, you know, although there's been a surge in secondhand market, and we've seen that grow by almost 8% in the last year alone, it's been focused really a lot on electronics, you know. And so with South Africans under pressure over the last couple of years, and the budget needs to be stretched further and further, It's not just about electronics. Yes, there's demand there. But what we're trying to achieve is sort of a broad spectrum of products. So having all of your, you know, your essential items, whether it be appliances, you know, baby goods, those kind of things, we're wanting to be sort of the main trusted source in the future of all of these products. And to do that, we've implemented a couple of things, which is, hey, obviously trust is a big thing. We know there's a lot of skepticism, and like you've said, and scams that have happened in this country continuously. I've fallen prey to a couple of them myself. So going through this, you understand what that journey is for a customer. What we've put in place is obviously a couple of things to build lots of trust, give people peace of mind. And we have first a grading system that allows us to look at every single product, which is based on functionality and sort of the cosmetics of the product. So that being, hey, you know, it has to be functional. And then what are the different tiers of sort of cosmetic, if you, you know, sort of damage that this product might have? And the reason you have these different grades is because it allows you to give people different access at different price points. So a grade A might be almost as good as new, whereas a grade C might be functional, but might have, for example, on a phone, back cover that's cracked. Now, some people will opt to take those products, some won't, but we want to give them optionality. And we're pretty clear about, hey, this is what it looks like. This is what the product is. And if you're willing to take it at this point, then great. On top of that, we offer warranties on each one of these products. So you've got a 3-month warranty and you have a 7-day return policy as well. We're also, you know, with the boom of e-commerce, we understand that there's a lot of scams out there. So we're wanting people to sort of see the product, see the stores that we're going to be putting up shortly, and have the ability to build some trust in this brand by going through the process. What we have done is also partnered on the back end with suppliers that are sort of, you know, very trustworthy. So you've got, you know, some of your big retailers that are supplying product to us, as well as sort of medium term size businesses that will also do the same. So it's backed by sort of not just we've popped up from nowhere. We're trying to find a way to take this, you know, damaged and secondhand product and find a way to funnel it to consumers across the market.
All right, Mishan, the grade and guarantee model really does sound reassuring, but your difficulty, I imagine, is going to ensure consistency and integrity in that process as your business starts to scale.
100%. So we've thought about these things and we've already implemented these pieces, and you have a full sort of operational team with technical people and engineers that sit in the back and look at every single product, and they're graded as soon as they get to us, and then sort of put into different buckets of this is A, B, and C. And we ensure that there's, you know, sort of very solid processes put in place to make sure that it meets those particular standards. If a product doesn't meet any of those standards, it obviously goes back into the reassessment process. And if it is sort of slipped through the cracks, which sometimes does, and ends up with a customer, we have the ability for customers to go and return this for a full refund. And on top of that, we're also saying, hey, listen, since we're a new brand and new business, we will guarantee this, and we will have the warranties behind it, and we will deliver and collect this product for free from you if you have an issue at any point and anywhere in the country.
I want to come back to this trust issue, which I think is critical to your success. And you talk about making reuse aspirational and not cheap, all well and good. But the problem, as I see it, is that you're still going to have to overcome a perception gap between buying new and buying refurbished. Often buying refurbished means buyer beware.
Sure. So, I mean, it is an interesting topic, and I think there's always going to be people that are skeptical about buying refurbished goods. I think that is just who we are as South Africans. We want, you know, sort of new stuff all of the time. But I think things are changing. I think people are starting to make compromises. I mean, if I use
out of desperation.
The car market is, well, I don't know if it's out of desperation. I think it's, you know, people want functionality, but they just can't afford it. So surely somebody should be able to provide that. If you look at the car market, for example, I mean, the secondhand car market is in the last year is larger than, in terms of sales, larger than the primary market. That tells me a lot, right? It says that, you know, it is a necessity. People need this stuff. And you've got people that are willing to take a product that's been utilized for a longer period of time, as long as it's in a good state, right? And I'd be willing to pay the money to use that product because it gives me the functionality. It is still aspirational depending on some of the products that people buy. And you can build trust into that. That's obviously a long-term sort of journey that happens for us to build trust. It's not going to happen overnight. It's as this grows and as we get better and better at what we do, and we get better at obviously the grading pieces, and that's how we end up building the trust. There's always going to be skepticism and people talking about scams and those kind of things. It's about having a clear point of contact and the ability to interact with our customers pretty freely to resolve those problems quickly.
Mishan, let me circle back to your comment about partnering with big retailers to move, demo models and damaged box goods. It's smart. There's no doubt about that. But is there not a danger within your business model that you might create dependency on large supply chains?
Well, I mean, as this evolves, you've seen different kind of models existed in the market. So there's obviously this partner model where it goes, hey, you've got you know, these big retailers. And it depends on how much of that sale comes through into your business. Remember, they're not going to, in a traditional sense, go and allocate all of their stock to you. They're still selling it themselves, right? So you're sort of in a partnership, but your timing is very important. So you can't only rely on sort of the bigger guys. You've got to sort of diversify your supply stream. So at some point, and what you've seen in other businesses, is that there's trade-in. So consumers can give their products back. Yes, it's something we'd want to work to at a later stage. But like you're saying, going back to the trust issue, is that we need to make sure that we have reliable sources so that we can build this effectively before going into something that is sort of uncharted, where it's, hey, I'm not sure what customers are giving to me, and it might take me a longer time and to assess those products. So how do we get to a point where we can give customers sort of confidence in the fact that these products are sourced effectively, reviewed effectively? And one of them is obviously the retail piece. There's obviously other smaller businesses that we get product from as well. So there's a multitude of suppliers that sit within the market that are actually trusted and have gone through a process themselves through procurement and those kind of things, which we can trust and which we have been dealing with for a longer period of time. So that's part of how we're trying to get the trust, but also ensuring that we diversify the supply chain on our side.
Well, I salute a good idea, and I certainly respect entrepreneurship, so I wish you all the very best of luck. That is Mishan Ratan, who is Managing Director of The Hawker. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.